Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. The UN Human Rights Office expressed deep concern on Tuesday at the high number of executions in Saudi Arabia, which have been happening almost daily in the last 2 weeks. 17 men have been put to death since the 10th of November, ending a 21-month unofficial moratorium on the use of the death penalty for drug-related offences. According to the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights, a Jordanian man, Hussein Abu Al-Khair, may be at risk of imminent execution too. His case has been examined previously by the UN Working Group on Arbitrary Detention, which cited grave concerns about his right to a fair trial. In an appeal to the Saudi government to quash Mr. Al-Khair's death sentence, the UN Rights Office maintained that the resumption of executions for drug-related offences was deeply regrettable, all the more so after a wide majority of states in the UN General Assembly called for a moratorium on the death penalty worldwide. More than 40 people have been killed in Iran in the past week amid ongoing protests sparked 2 months ago by the death of Jina Mahsa Amini in custody after her arrest for not wearing her hijab properly. According to the UN Human Rights Office, OHCHR, security officers reportedly responded forcefully to demonstrations in several mainly Kurdish cities on Monday evening, including Javanrud and Saqqez, said OHCHR spokesperson Jeremy Lawrence. He added that two 16-year-old boys were among six people killed at the weekend and that there's deep concern that the authorities have refused to release the bodies of the dead to their families.
With respect to the bodies not being returned to their families, of course that's of great concern to us. What is the motive behind that? I'm not sure. But the families have the right to have the bodies of their loved ones returned to them. It's cruel that they're not.
Protesters have been killed in 25 of Iran's 31 provinces, including more than 100 in Sistan and Balochistan. The UN Rights Office has urged the Iranian authorities to address people's demands for equality, dignity and rights, instead of using unnecessary or disproportionate force to suppress the protests. Ahead of the International Day for the Elimination of Violence Against Women this Friday, UN Chief Antonio Guterres urged all nations to take a stand and consign such abuse to the history books. Every 11 minutes, a woman or girl is killed by an intimate partner or family member, the Secretary-General said on Tuesday, before adding that even more physical and verbal abuse has resulted from COVID-19 and economic turmoil. Activists who are calling for change and who help survivors of violence need more support, Mr. Guterres insisted, as he called on governments to increase funding by 50% to women's rights movements by 2026. Without positive action from governments to end the scourge, the UN Secretary-General insisted that the discrimination, violence and abuse that half of humanity faces would continue to come at a steep cost. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
Good afternoon, listeners. Welcome to Radio Free Kansas. I hope you'll tune back during the week. We always offer very informative, news-dense programming. Coming up in the second hour, Maria Gilardin's TUC Radio, and it sounds like a very interesting one for today.
Imperial San Francisco by Gray Brecken. Brecken opens chapter 1 with a metaphor by the poet Edgar Allan Poe.
Nothing that fell within the maelstrom's reach could resist the suction of the vortex. Ships vanished. Hapless whales and bears were dragged howling into the hole. Very apt metaphor for what cities do to the natural world. They pull everything into it and then spit it out.
On the next broadcast of TUC Radio.
That's in the second hour, following Alex Smith's Radio EcoShock, which is coming up. And I hope you're stay tuned and check it out. Maria Gilardin is a very unusual radio host, podcaster. Well, it's not just a podcast. She's actually broadcasted on over 60 radio stations around the world. I mean, I'm giving you the best I can get. Plus, she had the bravery to take out on her own several years ago and build, with help, a off-the-grid home where believe it's powered by solar. She produces a show completely off the grid from her home in generally Northern California. So I hope you take her with a grain of salt. She's salt of the earth. Now, coming up is the latest headlines from this morning's Democracy Now! You should always go and check out democracynow.org in order to see these stories that sometimes Amy leads into. Now, she's been broadcasting for the last week and a half, 2 weeks, from Egypt, covering the COP27 United Nations climate meeting. So it's always good to check her out, especially in the mornings when she first broadcasts. But if you missed it, every weekday you'll get the morning headlines.
From Cairo, Egypt, this is Democracy Now!
The nationwide protest began on the 16th of September. Over 300 people have been killed, including more than 40 children. Two 16-year-old boys were among six killed over the weekend. Protesters have been killed in 25 of Iran's 31 provinces.
The situation in Iran is critical, with reports of children being killed, injured, and detained at anti-government protests. We'll get an update. Then Noam Chomsky remembers Staunton Lynn, the longtime peace and civil rights activist, lawyer, historian, and author who's died at the age of 92.
He had quite a remarkable life, very significant intellectual contributions. His one of the most important for me was his book on intellectual origins of American radicalism.
And finally, after Vice President Kamala Harris's visit to the Philippines, we'll speak with Filipino climate activist Yeb Sanyo about the creation of a loss and damage fund at the UN Climate Summit in Sharm el-Sheikh.
I think this establishing this fund is an expression of human solidarity for those who did not cause this problem but bear the brunt of its impact.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting from Cairo, Egypt. In Chesapeake, Virginia, a gunman shot dead at least six people inside a Walmart Tuesday night. CNN reports the suspect is believed to be an employee or former employee of the store. There are reports he opened fire on other Walmart workers in a break room. Authorities have confirmed the shooter also died, possibly of a self-inflicted gunshot wound. The shooting at the Walmart comes just 3 days after a gunman shot dead five people at Club Q, an LGBTQ+ nightclub in Colorado Springs. According to the Gun Violence Archive, there have been more than 600 mass shootings in the United States this year. House Democrats investigating Donald Trump may soon have access to 6 years of his tax returns. On Tuesday, the U.S. Supreme Court rejected the former president's attempt to block the Treasury Department from turning over his tax returns. The court's ruling ends a three-year battle, but comes just weeks before the Democrats lose control of the House. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has accused Russia of turning the cold winter weather into a weapon of mass destruction by attacking Ukraine's energy infrastructure. Millions of Ukrainians are expected to go months without heat or electricity following recent Russian strikes. The head of the Ukrainian power grid warned Tuesday of mass blackouts.
For you to understand the scale of these attacks and what we have to deal with, practically all thermal and hydro generation, meaning major power stations, have been damaged by missile attacks.
In other news on the war, Russia's denounced Ukrainian security forces for raiding a 1,000-year-old Russian Orthodox Christian monastery in Kyiv. as part of a probe into whether the religious site is being used to assist Russia's war efforts. Over the past 9 months, Ukrainian forces have arrested at least 33 Orthodox priests on suspicion of aiding Russia. Meanwhile, in Moscow, Russian President Vladimir Putin met Tuesday with the Cuban President Miguel Diaz-Canel, who criticized U.S. sanctions targeting Russia.
Cuba actively condemns sanctions that unilaterally and unfairly are imposed over the Russian Federation. The reasons for the current conflict in this zone must be sought in the aggressive policy of the United States and the expansion of NATO towards Russian borders.
Turkey is threatening to launch a ground invasion of northern Syria as part of its ongoing assault on Kurdish groups in the area following a deadly bombing in Istanbul on November 13th. Turkey's claiming it's killed 184 Kurds in recent attacks on northern Syria and Iraq. Meanwhile, Iran is escalating its own attack on Kurdish areas. One Kurdish human rights group estimates 42 people have been killed over the last week. We'll have more on Iran after headlines. Brazil's far-right president, Jair Bolsonaro, has formally filed a petition with Brazilian election authorities contesting the results of last month's runoff election, which he lost to former President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva. Bolsonaro has asked Brazil's Superior Electoral Court to toss out votes cast on older electronic voting machines, claiming without proof that the machines are faulty. Bolsonaro's request is expected to be rejected, but could raise tensions in Brazil ahead of Lula's inauguration on January 1st. In Colombia, new peace talks have begun between the Colombian government and the country's last remaining leftist guerrilla group, the National Liberation Army, or ELN. Colombia's first ever leftist president, Gustavo Petro, who's a former member of the guerrilla group M19, pushed for the negotiations to resume for the first time since 2019 in an effort to end nearly 60 years of conflict. This is Danilo Rueda, Colombia's high peace commissioner.
We believe that respect for differences unites us towards a common purpose. Respect for life, respect for freedom, and respect for the changes necessary to overcome a set of rights issues and inequalities that have been denied to so many sectors of the Colombian society. And this internal exercise that we are beginning to develop is what gives us certainty.
In Jerusalem, at least one person has died and 14 were injured after bombs exploded at two crowded bus stops this morning. Israeli authorities believe the bombs were likely detonated remotely. One of the blasts killed a 16-year-old Israeli-Canadian yeshiva student named Aryeh Shechopek. The attack in Jerusalem came hours after Israeli forces shot dead a 16-year-old Palestinian boy named Ahmed Shahada in the occupied West Bank. Palestinian officials say the teenager was shot in the heart during an Israeli military raid. So far this year, Israeli forces have killed at least 200 Palestinians, including more than 50 children. In China, hundreds of workers at the world's largest iPhone factory have clashed with Chinese police after walking off the job. Tension has been rising at the Foxconn plant over strict COVID-19 lockdowns and unpaid wages. Videos posted on social media show workers being tear-gassed and beaten outside the plant. The Biden administration's extended a pause on federal student loan payments until the end of June as a court battle drags on over Biden's plan to cancel up to $20,000 of student debt per borrower. In a statement, Education Secretary Miguel Cardona said, quote, "We're extending the payment pause because it would be deeply unfair to ask borrowers to pay a debt that they wouldn't have to pay were it not for the baseless lawsuits brought by Republican officials and special interests," he said. The city of Atlanta has agreed to pay $1 million to the family of Rayshard Brooks, an unarmed 27-year-old African-American man who was shot dead by the police in 2020. The incident began when officers found him sleeping in a car in the parking lot of a Wendy's restaurant. Police shot him in the back as he attempted to run away from them after grabbing one of their tasers. One officer was heard on a body cam video saying, "I got him." A coalition of over 400 immigrant justice and human rights groups are urging the Biden administration to grant temporary protected status, or TPS, to more people from Haiti as the island nation faces a political and economic crisis with violence increasing in the streets. The efforts led by the Haitian Bridge Alliance are calling for current beneficiaries of TPS to be given more time in the program and for Biden officials to expand the relief to Haitians who fled to the United States after July 2021. The program temporarily shields immigrants from deportation and grants them permission to work in the U.S. TPS for Haitians is currently set to expire in 3 months, in February of 2023. In labor news, the head of the American Federation of Teachers, Randy Weingarten, is denouncing former Secretary of State and possible presidential candidate Mike Pompeo after he claimed she was, quote, the most dangerous person in the world. Randy Weingarten said she suspects Pompeo made the comment in an appeal to billionaire Republican funders who want to dismantle public education.
This is the kind of rhetoric that creates the incitement and the hate and the divisiveness that we're seeing in America and around the world today. Let me be clear. What the AFT does and what teachers do every day in classrooms is that they're the antidote to this kind of destructive rhetoric.
More labor news. Starbucks is closing the first shop to unionize in Seattle, the coffee chain's home city. This is the fourth unionized Starbucks store in Seattle to be shut down since nationwide unionization efforts started. Starbucks CEO Howard Schultz warned in a video more stores would be closed soon, claiming safety concerns, but union leaders say the closures are part of the company's ongoing retaliation campaign against workers organizing. And Bloomberg's reporting Elon Musk's fortune has shrunk by over $100 billion this year due to the falling value of Tesla shares. Despite losing $100 billion, the new owner of Twitter remains the world's richest man. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report.
Coming up this Friday and every Friday, Freedom from Religion on Free Thought Friday here on Radio Free Kansas.
For radio as godless as our Constitution, tune in to Free Thought Radio. I'm Dan Barker.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor. We are co-hosts of Free Thought Radio, radio for the rest of us, freethinkers, atheists, and agnostics.
Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews.
From the secular point of view.
That's every Friday, and you get it, as we do. If you've figured out yet, if you're a regular listener, I always give you the latest news and brief from the United Nations Radio. And as well, I usually try to put in this morning's Democracy Now! That depends if it's put up on YouTube where I rip it from. Okay, now we're doing Alex Smith's Radio EcoShock. It's the largest environmental radio show on 105 radio stations from border British Columbia, Canada. And Alex's been doing this a long time, and he knows about every scientist, I think, in the world on climate change. It's very scientific. He does very methodical work. He has for years. Go to his website. It's called ecoshock.org, and a huge archive, a library of environmental science.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
From Johannesburg, Professor Patrick Bond exposes the just transition and dirty deeds done. Two reports from COP27 in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt, Daphne Wysham and Paul Beckwith call in. This is Radio EcoShock.
If we don't help emerging economies avoid the fossil fuel trap, this civilization will crash over the climate cliff. At COP26 last year, a trial plan was agreed, but somehow the green has turned to black. To get the inside story, we go to Dr. Patrick Bond, professor of sociology at the University of Johannesburg in South Africa. Now, he was born in Northern Ireland. He was educated at a high school in Alabama, got a degree from Wharton, a doctorate at Johns Hopkins. Bond worked for social justice in Philly and D.C., and then went for the big battle for civil rights in South Africa. He played a role advising the new South African government of Nelson Mandela. From Johannesburg, Patrick Bond, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Hey, thanks very much for having me, Alex. It's a really important time to talk about the climate, isn't it?
Indeed, indeed. You recently returned from the country of Mauritius. What took you there?
Well, there's an amazing progressive movement that works on environment, and it's called Resistance Alternative. And they're extremely good at pulling people from the region, defenders of the Indian Ocean. And this island has had gone through some tough times. I mean, they haven't been hit with the awful cyclones that neighboring Madagascar has. They had three in about a week or so this year, as well as a drought. But they've had shipwrecks in 2021 that actually dumped oil all over. And this group, Resistance Alternative, became famous for finding artisanal boom strategies to keep the oil away. They basically wrapped up the sugarcane husks as well as human hair, and they put several kilometers of these booms to prevent the oil slick from spreading into the very sensitive coral reef areas. And I think one of the most extraordinary things is that they come from a socialist perspective in doing this. It's a very strong tradition of revolutionary socialism, and they've turned to the environment. So if anyone is interested, John Bellamy Foster from Monthly Review is also out and about in Mauritius. And this is the kind of network that I think unites the sort of forces of progressive broad organizing with our region's environmentalists. And the political ecology school was a real treat for me. I learned much more than I could even begin to contribute in my talks.
Yes, but on the other end of the spectrum, the parties to the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change met again in Africa, this time in a resort at Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt. Patrick, is that a good place to discuss climate justice?
Well, it's pretty typical, isn't it? I mean, we're going to see them again in the region, Middle East, next year at the United Arab Emirates, Dubai. And this is now becoming a bit of a joke. It's so much so that Greta Thunberg, the Swedish youth activist, decided she wouldn't even bother legitimizing them by showing up. There are plenty of good climate activists there, no question, but they're not allowed to do anything. They have small tokenistic demonstrations, but their ability to lobby is limited. And indeed, the fossil fuel companies have shown up in force, so over 670 delegates. And the major breakthrough, I think, if there is going to be one, is the loss and damage demand. And here in South Africa, we've had extraordinary rain bombs, two that hit Durban, the first one on April 11, killing about 500 people. And the way things are organized, there were very few who were middle class, and they were entirely black residents of Durban, because the shacks and the low-income housing, the areas where people are living near the floodplains and on the hills, are very vulnerable. And so this was one of the ways that the race class aspects of post-apartheid South Africa, even in some ways worse than the apartheid era in terms of poverty, inequality, unemployment, and ecological degradation, really hit home. So loss and damage is very important, partly because very few of the people who were injured or certainly the families of those who lost their loved ones have been compensated. And instead, a major car company, Toyota, has been the main beneficiary of the sort of building back, for example, to put in some stormwater drainage at long last. So this is a kind of good reflection that we hear in South Africa, including with the minister, Barbara Creasy is her name, in charge of the United Nations subcommittee within the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, dealing with loss and damage. And she's not well liked here because she has done very, very little to, you know, sort of help on environmental justice and stop pollution that kills a couple of thousand people a year in some of the main pollution hotspots. So in short, we're not too optimistic given that sort of leadership, and that the United States and its, the middle tier allies that you spoke of in the intro, the sort of, I would call them the sub-imperial layer, and that begins with China, the big polluter, which, per person is way, way less than the United States, and historically is far less than the United States. But both of them came out this week to decline to fund loss and damage on grounds that that could open up liability. And so we may see some small amount go to a loss and damage fund, even from some U.S. contributions. But the critical thing that they seem to really want to avoid, and they wrote into the Paris Climate Agreement, is that there's no liability. There's no, let's call it the polluter pays principle, the kind of principle, Alex, that has been so widely accepted in your Environmental Protection Agency. That's the basis of the Superfund that was set up in the late 70s under Jimmy Carter to try to get to grips with the huge toxic dumps all over and to charge the companies that polluted. And that simple logic, which is both ethically and economically efficient, it's ethically necessary because the people who've caused the problems, people in the global north, I include myself in a middle-class suburb of Johannesburg, we are just simply not being compelled to pay, and hence the problem continues.
Yes, with the climate disaster gaining on us, the global north must find a way to help with clean renewable energy. So a group of wealthier countries decided on South Africa as a pilot project for a just energy transition partnership. I don't know a lot about it, but Patrick, let's be generous. What was the stated goal and hope of this project?
Yes, yeah, so, I mean, I think we could be generous, at least to say what should be the basis for the north paying even a middle-income country, South Africa, the amount $8.5 billion, and we would have hoped it would have been a grant, not further loans, and South Africa's foreign debt already at about $175 billion. Really, we shouldn't be compelled to borrow, especially because the currency is declining rapidly, and if we borrow in a U.S. dollar, the lenders don't take our South African rand seriously. We have to convert to dollars, and as our rand declines, the effective interest rate becomes ludicrously high. So this is one of the major, you know, let's say it's technical detail, but it's one that really affects the price. We also wanted genuine concessional finance, very, very low interest rates. The U.S., of course, being greedy and with the neoliberal agenda of both Joe Biden and his climate czar, John Kerry, they're only giving the market rate loans to South Africa, about 9% a year. And then they're providing guarantees to private lenders from the U.S. who will contribute. So what's this money supposed to be for? If we could be generous, we would say it would be the way that a northern country would pay a southern country to leave fossil fuels underground. And that's the way it was phrased even by the South Africans in the annual nationally determined contributions that they're proposing. These countries say, this is what we'll do. And South Africa's huge coal reserves and 85% reliance for the electricity in a laptop, for example, that I'm talking to you through, that would require us to really make rapid changes to decarbonize, to basically close those coal-fired power plants down early and leave the coal in the hole. We also have gas offshore, and we should not be taking the gas. So in a generous interpretation, the $8.5 billion should be done as a grant in exchange for leaving our fossil fuels underground. We should do it all over. You know, the sort of original idea for this was from Ecuador. It was a place called Yasuni on the Peruvian border in the Amazon, where there was about $10 billion worth of oil in the demand from a then progressive government of Rafael Correa in the 2006, 2007, when it got up and running, was that the West would give $3.5 billion, and that would be in grants to the Ecuadorian government, which would use it for social programs. So that's a good way to think about the North paying a down payment, really, a small amount, really, compared to what's owed on the climate debt, and the South saying, okay, so we won't use the atmospheric space that is, you know, really fairly ours to use, but instead of extracting fossil fuels or engaging in a highly fossil-dependent development path, we'll take some money and we'll use that to have a different way to empower our people. Unfortunately, the $8.5 billion is going to Eskom mostly, as well as some electric vehicle subsidies to BMW, VW, Mercedes, a few other car companies. Unfortunately, these are companies your listeners may know that cheated on their emissions, and California actually picked up the cheating in the VW scandal in 2015, and it was a really serious scandal. It cost VW 18 billion euros in fines. But they're the ones getting these subsidies, and they're going to export the electric vehicles. There's some talk of green hydrogen that'll go through a really awful company called Sasol, the second worst polluter. But really, let's talk about what you would do if you wanted to pay this electricity company, it's called Eskom, not to engage in more fossil fuel extraction and not to have not simply coal, but also methane gas plants, which are proposed. Well, unfortunately, the guys that are dealing, and let me name a name in the United States, a famous negotiator called Jonathan Pershing from the U.S. State Department, very close ally of a man called Todd Stern, who Hillary Clinton and then John Kerry depended upon for basically managing the U.S. role in the UN, and they were notorious for refusing to acknowledge climate debt and really refusing to do what was right to cut emissions and adopt any of the climate justice principles. And unfortunately, Jonathan Pershing was put in charge of this. And just before Glasgow, over a year ago, he came to South Africa and organized this $8.5 billion with his mates. And they were from Britain. And then they were hosting Glasgow COP26, and also Germany and France and the EU as a whole. So these five, let's say, governments, EU including, but also separate from France and Germany, with a World Bank component. And they are very self-interested, all of them, in having ESCOM get more money. And the reason is they've all lent to ESCOM for coal-fired power plants. And the most notorious, Medupi and Kasile, that's the majority of the debts that this company owes, they really shouldn't have been lent any money. These lenders shouldn't have, especially for a coal-fired power plant. But it was known as they were lending that the company, ESCOM, the parastatal state agency, was already corrupted by a company from Japan, Hitachi. And the reason we can say this openly, that Hitachi bribed our ruling party, the African National Congress, is because the United States has a Foreign Corrupt Practices Act that was actually in 2015 deployed, and Hitachi was prosecuted, and successfully it was paid a fine, a small fine, about $19 million. Unfortunately, the fine was paid to the U.S., not to our people, our taxpayers, or our government here in South Africa. And this is a real indication that the lenders really shouldn't be collecting. They should take the proverbial haircut on the loan, and we should call that loan an odious debt and repudiate it. And unfortunately, the $8.5 billion is a money that's what we call fungible. It goes into the ESCOM treasury, and it goes out in the form of loan repayments, as well as the ambition of the ESCOM leader, whose name is André de Ruyter, and he wants to have 44% of the new money coming in to be used for gas plants, and the gas would emanate from Cabo Delgado, Mozambique. It's famous around the world now because it's where Islamic guerrillas, with some strong support in parts of the population, are trying to fight against the extraction. They're guerrillas who don't necessarily have an environmental ideology, but they certainly see that the resource curse of Mozambique, which is right there, the Rovuma Basin, one of the biggest gas fields in the world, has led Total from Paris, Total Energies, as well as ExxonMobil from Houston, and Eni from Rome, and China National Petroleum Corporation to set up a massive facility for Total. They put in $20 billion, single biggest investment in Africa. And that means if they can go forward with this gas extraction, they'll create a much more climate change through methane, which is 85 times more potent than CO2. And the point being, just to wrap this huge contradiction up, is that this area, the east side of Mozambique and the Mozambique Channel, gets very hot, and the water goes above 30 degrees centigrade, and that means, I can't remember what that is in Fahrenheit, but close to 90, and that means that the cyclones get very serious. So one that hit in 2019, Alex, it's called Cyclone Kenneth, had 225 kilometer per hour winds, the fastest ever recorded in this part of the world, and the one just a month before that, Cyclone Idai, killed a couple of thousand people and went all the way from Mozambique up into Zimbabwe and Malawi. So we're talking about a really serious problem of the climate catastrophe hitting this very area, and this terrible irony that the French and Italian and U.S. and Chinese companies are there. And they, by the way, need protection. They need a local gendarme, local police, and the Mozambique army is useless. And so Emmanuel Macron, the French leader, actually visited both Kigali in Rwanda to see Paul Kagame and Cyril Ramaphosa, our president, in South Africa. That was in May 2021 after a big battle closed down Total. And as a result, we've put 1,000 of our troops, more than 1,000 Rwandans, into, unfortunately, not succeed much in resolving this dispute and not protecting the local people. The guerrillas are getting stronger. The army isn't doing very much. Total isn't confident enough to move back, but they are through Eni, the Italians, beginning to extract offshore, selling it through BP. And that means we are actually losing this battle on all the fronts involved. And it does mean that if you go to a place like Sharm el-Sheikh in Egypt, you see the Total Energies leader is a guy called Patrick Pouyanné, wandering around with a smug confidence that they can just continue business as usual.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
We are talking with Patrick Bond from the University of Johannesburg. It seems like Africa is now seen as a big target for more fossil fuel production. The companies that are making, the multinational companies that are making trillions of dollars of profits right now want to come in and start fracking, start more oil reserves. It's going to make Africa finally rich as it always deserved as their story, but it starts out green and it ends up black, just as I said in the introduction. Do you think that we are insane, or are we going to commit suicide this way, Patrick?
I wouldn't call it suicide because it's a lot of Africans have no responsibility. It's more murder, isn't it, by these guys like Patrick Pouyanné. I've studied him, and I have a piece in the current issue of Actuel Marx, a French journal. And Total Energies is particularly notorious, not just Mozambique, and also they have a pipeline, the East African Crude Oil Pipeline, EACOP, along with the Chinese to dig deep into Uganda, the Lake Albert area, and pump out through Tanzania. And so that's a huge battle that is being waged around the world with solidarity against EACOP. And Total then is also very active down our coastline. And we're fighting very hard, both Total and Shell and their local ally, Impact, as well as Petro SA, the local South African company. They are really being defeated by activists on the beaches, literally hundreds of protests over the past year, and tens of thousands of people involved from the fisher folk and the community, the shoreline sort of affected communities, but also the marine conservation, very sophisticated networks opposed to the seismic blasting, as well as the climate activists. And they come in both climate action and climate justice ideologies. And I've been very impressed. And I go to these beachline protests and to the ones here in Johannesburg in solidarity. And it's in the courts that our extremely good public interest lawyers have actually defeated these big oil companies. However, that means there's more pressure on these oil companies to go dig elsewhere, like next door in Namibia. They found some big gas fields. And as you say, all over the continent, there's more exploration. And the tragic aspect is partly that Vladimir Putin's invasion of Ukraine meant that sanctions, oil and gas and even coal sanctions from Europe, makes the European leaders like Olaf Scholz, German Chancellor, actually physically visit Africa with his charming, smarmy, approach and actually look in Senegal for gas, in Nigeria for oil, and here in South Africa for coal. His visit in May this year was just appalling, just as he was about to host the G7. And of course, he has a very prominent role in the $8.5 billion just energy transition. So enormous hypocrisy, where the Europeans are saying, no, we should decarbonize, we'll give you some money too. But then they're encouraging more fossil fuel exports to their own coal-fired power plants, which have just been opened up. Look, I hope they can survive this winter, and it's going to be a very, very important period for them to very rapidly move into more renewables and better storage systems. And so maybe in the medium and long term, we can look at this as a blessing in disguise. But what we see in Africa is more stranded assets and co-opted African leaders who've been in Sharm el-Sheikh, basically lobbying to have Africa excused to get a little bit more oil and gas, which, as you observe, say profits go to the elites and to the Western and Chinese oil companies, and they leave the Africans with pollution and underdevelopment and oppression.
Would you believe, Patrick, that we hear about absolutely none of this in the Western media? You know, what you've just told me is all news. So what can we do to try and bridge this gap before we wreck yet another continent with fossil fuels?
Well, I'd love the progressives listening here to begin to think about the climate debt and what sort of solidarity. So let me give you one example. It's not the U.S. example. The U.S. has been exceptionally good with anti-apartheid solidarity during the 70s and 80s. That's when I was studying in Baltimore and in Philadelphia. I'd learned my politics very much through that movement and African Americans leading us fighting racism and also an anti-corporate boycott, divestment, sanctions strategy. So the solidarity is in our veins. We know what can be done from Western countries where good people fight their own elites. And I think that would be the spirit, wouldn't it? In Germany, for example, they're recognizing that the genocide of the Namibians, the Herero and the Nama people, by the German colonialists just over 100 years ago require reparations. And so Germans began by saying, we will give a basic income grant through the Lutheran Church, as well as one of the big unions, IG Metall, the metal workers. And what they did was quite remarkable. They said to, as a pilot, just let's take a village. And the village, like many in rural areas, is mainly populated by women. The men have done their migration to look for jobs. And so they would give everybody, it was only about $10 a month, but it did an enormous amount of good in this place, Ochivero. To me, it was a pilot, Alex, for how the West can indeed start solidaristic work so that you and people like me in the Global North here in Johannesburg should start figuring out how a system of climate debt would pay people in especially massively storm and, you know, sort of extreme weather affected areas, drought areas, flooded areas, areas where there's rising seawaters, so that we would start making perhaps that same sort of basic income grant of cash donation where people would otherwise not really survive without it. And I think those are the kinds of creative ways forward, these Germans in the Lutheran Church in Ochivero, Namibia, with very good local activists promoting them from Windhoek. It's a basic income grant that can be found on the web. And also, I would say the other way to, again, provide that solidarity, like Yasuni in Ecuador, is to try to find areas where conservation can be confirmed by local progressives, again, with some monetary compensation to people. It's really about how to pay a climate debt, isn't it? And it's not only, as I say, the sort of loss and damage we've been describing, like Durban. It's also adaptation. It's costing a lot to build the stormwater drainage, the better irrigation systems for rural people, and so forth. And then also to compensate Africans for not using the atmospheric space. Those are the sorts of messages I hope. And, you know, the most important thing of all, get your governments to force companies to stop emitting. People are recognizing how to do that. It's the contradictions that Joe Biden's politics, Charles Schumer and Joe Manchin coming up with their side deals. You have to watch those guys every moment. And I know there are fantastic climate justice folk all over the United States doing just that. And it was heartening to know that Manchin actually lost at the end of September in trying to cut a deal to open up more federal lands for oil and gas. So more power to all of you who are engaged in those battles.
I think there's just such hypocrisy because there is a reticence among even some Greens in the West to say, yes, we'll pay climate reparations because we know it will go to corrupt African governments. But the corruption is coming right from the World Bank. It's coming right from the multinational corporations. And the products that have to be bought always come back to be purchased from the West. And the extra interest and collapsing currencies always benefit the West. It's very difficult to say how we're going to get around this reparations thing and get the money in the ways that you just described directly to the people who need it, with better drainage ditches, with better shelters, with cooling centers, with all the things people are going to need just to survive this climate change.
Well, that's right, Alex. And the challenge you're putting to us in Africa is to come up with ways around corrupt government, and certainly there are, and they're often corrupted by multinationals. Just as one reflection, the first action of the provincial governor, right, that's equivalent of a U.S. state governor named Sihle Zikalala in Durban, was to arrange that the water tanker that was going out to the communities would actually route first to his own personal house, his mansion. And so that was, he was very embarrassed when that came out. The neighbors nailed him. It was useful to have that reflection of how venal and greedy some of these leaders are. And I think it's at that level where activists in this part of the world, certainly in Zimbabwe when the cyclone Idai hit, and they didn't want the government, the sort of coup government against Robert Mugabe, a guy called Emmerson Mnangagwa, and his finance minister, Ntuli Ndube, and they activists in the Center for Natural Resource Governance said, actually, don't pay the climate debt, don't pay emergency funds to these characters. Here's a whole bunch of civil society forces that really could use it. I think giving people who are desperately hard hit, and there are, of course, systems to do that with relative, you know, accuracy and very small admin fees, basic income grants through, you know, people get funding on the phones these days, and you can easily identify where they're coming from and their residence. And we need to set these up. We also need the emergency systems. We have a very good group that goes all over the world based in Durban called Gift of the Givers, a Muslim group, and they're perfectly adequate in receiving funds for emergencies, and they do a better job than any government I've ever seen. And I think it's that, let's say, quality control that the activists on at least the South African and Southern African side are beginning to say, yeah, well, maybe the states we're dealing with, if we give them big funds, they'll actually use it to buy guns and put us down even faster. I think those are good questions. We have to be able to come up with an answer like a basic income grant that would make sure that ordinary people who are terribly affected by these extreme events actually are compensated.
Well, I want to get in a quick plug here for a friend of mine who's a volunteer with the American Red Cross, and she's traveling to the different hurricane zones and the wildfires and finding people burned out and helping them. And they're really short of volunteers, so they're not asking for money. They're asking for people who have the time to show up and help them. And I'll put a lot more about that in my blog. You've been at this a long time, Patrick Bond. How do you look forward? How do you see your own role now?
Well, I'm an armchair academic, always have been, but it's very easy for someone in the middle class to find an extra moment to encourage, to do analysis, to do critical work against the corporates in the state, because there are next generations coming through. So although we still have our, you know, the classic South African left divisions, there's plenty of little, you know, factions, and we have about three or four different climate justice movements. What's really great, and I even saw this on Amy Goodman's show this week, where she highlighted one young South African, and it's, to me, just a terrific, let's say, boost to my own energy and hope that next generations are coming through with exceptional militancy, and I think also a very healthy generational rage. And they're also picking up an issue that when we work on gender and race and LGBTQI and class and all the other ways in which climate is very biased, we're also now being confronted with something that's so profound, it really is the definition of sustainable development, which is future generations. That is, are we screwing up our environment so much now with, for example, extractive industries, the mining sector that's so powerful here, that we're leaving the next generations with huge deficits? And that's definitely the case. And I salute the youth who get angry at our my generation. I'm 61, and it's time for us to look in the mirror and say, well, yeah, future generations are going to be part of our whole set of affected constituencies that need a voice. And we should be listening very carefully to the youth who try to begin to articulate that.
We have been speaking with Professor Patrick Bond from the University of Johannesburg, and I will put a link to his work and his recent co-authored article, How Not to Offer Climate Finance, as published at counterpunch.org. You can find these links and a way to pass on this interview in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Patrick, thank you for coming back here for our listeners.
Well, it's great to be with you. And just two words to end, Alex. The two words are local vernacular in different languages here. They mean power to the people. Mandla. Away to.
Thank you so much. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
From Sharm el-Sheikh, Alex talks with Daphne Wysham, longtime host of Earthbeat Radio, now campaigning against the super warming gas methane.
Daphne, you are CEO at methaneaction.org. At the COP27 Climate Summit, have you heard new science or news about the super global warming gas methane?
Well, yes, we have. You know, at COP26 in Glasgow, methane was the topic on day one. It's kind of been buried here at COP27. There's a much greater focus here on loss and damage and on getting the U.S. and other developed countries to pony up the money for loss and damage for countries like Pakistan that have been, you know, a third of the country was underwater recently due to heavy rains and flooding. But here in Sharm el-Sheikh, NGOs and scientists are calling on the delegates to specify binding targets and timelines for cutting methane emissions. And also, we are leading the charge in pushing for the development of methane removal technologies. As your listeners may know, there's very little in the way of transparency around actual methane emissions. In fact, the U.S. and many other countries are misreporting and underestimating their methane emissions by a long shot. So we need accurate measurement, reporting, and verification. And until we have that, we have no way of knowing if countries are actually taking action or just talking a good game. Now, we do have the Global Methane Pledge, and over 100, and I think at last count, it's over 140 countries have taken on this pledge, which is a voluntary pledge to cut their methane emissions by 30% below 2020 levels by 2030. But today, we and a number of other NGOs are calling for a mandatory global methane agreement that would set binding targets for cutting methane emissions and lowering atmospheric methane levels. So, you know, we keep hearing that we need to keep 1.5 alive, 1.5 degrees Celsius, the target agreed to in Paris. And we know that a half a degree of the warming that we are, a half a degree of Celsius that we are now experiencing is attributable to methane. So it's a no-brainer that we should be pushing very hard on cutting methane and getting it out of the atmosphere if we want to keep Paris alive. But there's been an awful lot of pushback on even keeping that 1.5C target alive by some of the bigger emitters.
Now, you hosted a syndicated radio for years, Daphne, reporting out the environment on Earthbeat. You campaigned for Greenpeace before that. Is there an environment movement showing up at this COP?
Absolutely. I mean, I wouldn't say it's not just an environmental movement. It's a climate justice movement. And I've been going to the COP since Kyoto, and I would say that this is the most diverse COP I've been to in terms of the communities that are actually leading the charge within Climate Action Network and other global networks of NGOs. So it's heartening to see their engagement.
In the cross-section of people that you meet at Sharm el-Sheikh, how would you characterize the mood on a scale of from we are doomed to it's not so bad, humans can fix this?
I haven't done a poll, but I would say that I feel about 70% hope and 30% despair. You know, I think a lot of people are very concerned that there's an awful lot of brinkmanship going on here, as it always is in the final days of the COP. If we can keep not only 1.5 alive, but move on some of the commitments that were made in Glasgow to get all of the public financing from institutions like the World Bank out of fossil fuels and talk about a phase down in fossil fuels, not a phase out. That's a big distinction that India in particular wants to make, is that we don't need a phase out. We need a phase down because they want to continue consuming fossil fuels until way past 2050. So we do need to keep the pressure on in these last few days, and that's what we're trying to do.
And you mentioned the floods in Pakistan. Have current events added more urgency to the formal science and policy discussions?
It's perplexing that Florida's been underwater, Pakistan's been underwater. We have one scary event after another that's clearly linked to climate change happening all over the world. This COP has as a backdrop the high price of oil and the war between Russia and Ukraine. So a lot of people are concerned about how they can better access gas, for example, in the EU, which is too bad. On the other hand, you're seeing countries like the Ukraine pledging to not only meet but exceed their nationally determined contributions and move away from fossil fuels, which is very heartening.
Well, we're hearing some people saying this COP has failed, but there must be some things that are going on. What is the buzz at the COP27?
Well, I would say it is really about loss and damage and trying to get a facility set up that would channel the money for developing countries that have been hardest hit. So many of these countries are not only being pummeled by climate change, but then they are essentially beholden to some of the big development banks that have conditions on their loans and interest rates that drive them deeper into debt. And we really need to have concessional financing provided for countries that are suffering in some ways, not just from climate change, but from unemployment and from high gas prices and so on. So that's on the table now, and hopefully the reform of the multilateral development banks will be a priority going forward.
Is there anything else you would like to pass on to our listeners?
One of the things that I'm most hopeful about is the work that we are doing at Methane Action, and we have gotten the endorsement of James Hansen, former director of NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies. He's supported our call for not only aggressive reductions in methane emissions, but funding for research and development of methane removal technologies, and also an agreement that would be binding on methane emissions. We have a civil society sign-on statement that has been released to every member of the 1,500-plus Climate Action Network, endorsing the work we're doing. It's been endorsed by Oxfam International, Union of Concerned Scientists, Friends Committee on National Legislation, you name it. You know, folks from all over, from Africa, from Latin America have signed on. And I'm hoping that some of your listeners can go to our website and endorse that civil society sign-on statement and reflect on what's possible with the combination of aggressive cuts in methane emissions and methane removal. Our scientists tell us that we can, in fact, reduce warming by 0.6 degrees Celsius by mid-century with these two actions, methane mitigation and methane removal. But we really need to get going on cutting emissions now and getting the R&D funding in place and getting a really strong binding global methane agreement that will allow us to not only meet, but hopefully exceed in ambition the targets set in Paris.
I know a lot of our listeners are worried about methane. So where do they go to get more information about what you're doing?
Yes, it's methaneaction.org. One word, methaneaction.org. You can also follow me on Twitter, Daphne Wysham. We also have a Methane Action Twitter feed, and I try to keep that updated with regular posts every day.
From Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt, we've been speaking with longtime environmental activist and radio host Daphne Wysham. Thank you, Daphne.
Thank you so much, Alex.
Covering the world, this is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
From the COP27 climate conference in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt, Paul Beck with reports in. Paul is a Canadian climate scientist and the largest single science video provider on YouTube. Hello, Paul.
Hi, Alex.
So over 35,000 people talking climate in a weird holiday venue. It must be strange. How is it going, Paul?
For me, it's going all right. It's based Sharm el-Sheikh in Egypt, so it's in the south coast of the Sinai Peninsula. The actual place reminds me a bit of Las Vegas because it's definitely a large resort town, but there's not like a main strip. Like in Las Vegas, it's all along the coastlines and it's very hot.
As a kind of resident climate scientist there, you were on all seven of the panel presentations set from the climate emergency folks.
I just finished attending some presentations in a section called the Cryosphere Pavilion, which was sort of my, you know, main hangout at the COPs as in previous years, because there's all kinds of good talks on the cryosphere. So glaciers on Greenland and on Antarctica, the sea ice at both poles, and the Himalayan glaciers and so on. So lots of really good sessions. And I just came from a session with Jason Brock, who's the scientist probably most well known for his work on Greenland.
And one presenter was Dr. Jem Bendel, and Jem is a well-known sustainability expert. He was hired by governments and presented keynotes at major conferences. Then after a deep dive into climate science, he became critical of academics who were putting a bright face on coming disaster. At this COP, Bendel released new stats showing the denialist hashtag #PoundClimateScam went from 3,000 tweets a month most of the time to almost 100,000 monthly posts just in time for the climate conference. But tags like, well, you know, #PoundClimateJustice lags far behind. What does Bendel is thinking is going on with this sudden surge of the climate scam thing again?
Yeah, that was a very interesting slide that he showed where he just did that assessment on that hashtag. And, you know, the only thing I can think of is if you look also at some previous COPs, I mean, there seemed to be a surge on the nonsense tweets and nonsense social media posts, you know, about a month or two before the COP is about to start. So I think it's just the right-wing climate denier sphere, you know, sort of gearing up before major climate events. I think that's part of it. You know, along with the Climate Emergency Forum panels, which we had on a variety of topics, and today there were a couple particularly interesting ones on with the Center for Climate Repair at Cambridge, a group of scientists there that are working on, well, today's topic was ocean CDR, so methods in the ocean where you can remove carbon dioxide. The sessions are a mix of what's happening with the climate, what's happening with human response to the climate, you know, and different groups that are trying to do something about it, and also what sort of things can we do for on the sort of climate restoration front. You know, and I think that climate restoration will become bigger and bigger, but I mean, the focus at this COP is loss and damage. You know, the inequitability between the global north, who have created the vast bulk of the emissions, and the global south, who are bearing the brunt of some of the worst consequences of rapidly changing climate, mostly floods and droughts in other places, and you know, rising sea levels will affect many countries there.
After his presentation, you had a sit-down with Jem Bendel. What did you talk about, and how would you characterize his mood?
So I basically asked him to kind of elaborate a bit on, he's known as, probably the most famous paper was on deep adaptation, the idea that we need to change our way of life to address the climate problem, like at just adapting to things. If you're being hit by things from all different directions, and you're just trying to dodge them for mitigation, and you're just trying to figure out how to be resilient when they hit you for adaptation. But it has to go much beyond that. We have to really change how we do things in society to change the results, which is to try to come back from the brink of abrupt climate system change. So it was a lot of details in that. We talked about a bit about academia and the insular ivy tower nature, where, you know, academics by nature are more and more specialized. And, you know, as you get more and more specialized, you know more and more about less and less. So, you know, and these aren't practical ways of dealing with climate system change. You need to understand how all the pieces are changing and have policies to step back from it. So I also had a half-hour session where I chatted with Peter Fiakowski and about his book, Climate Restoration, which was just published this year.
So I'm guessing you did not shake hands with Al Gore or celebrities or Joe Biden or anything?
Well, I did manage to do so with Al Gore, actually, and it was just kind of random. I was walking around one of the buildings where there's each country has a different booth, and I happened to notice a schedule saying that, you know, Al Gore is going to be speaking at 6 o'clock. And then I talked to him afterwards briefly. When he is totally against any idea of geoengineering, as he called it, totally against it. I said, well, what about climate restoration? Would you be against climate restoration? And, you know, by that time there were swarms of people also asking questions, so I never got an answer to that. But yeah, you do see people, I mean, and you see them at unusual times. Like last night I was in an event there was a free dinner and presentation at a, I think, a four-star hotel. I was talking to a Polish reporter from Warsaw, and he was with a group, you know, and he said, that's the mayor of Warsaw right there beside me. And I thought that was quite interesting, the mayor of Warsaw. And then a few minutes later, they all started to look very concerned and upset and started talking in Polish, and I didn't know what was going on. So a little while later, I asked the reporter, well, what's happened? And he said, oh, he said some missiles have just gone into Poland, you know, and when they first hit, they thought it was Russian missiles. Some of the Polish people were clearly visibly very, very upset. So we talked a little bit about the cop that was in Poland not too long ago, 2 years ago, in Katowice, Poland, and, you know, about the influence that coal companies had on that conference. And people have probably read that, you know, there's more lobbyists here. There's a record number of fossil fuel lobbyists here, and actually the Canadian contingent, Canada has a pavilion, and where they'd be giving a number of talks. And Alberta people had a session, which I recorded. So I've got dozens of videos that I have to put up on my website. I find that the COP, there's so much packed into them that there's just no way I can keep. If I'm uploading videos, then I won't be taking more videos. You know what I mean? There's always something going on here. And the internet actually is being very flaky for me and extremely slow. And I did some speed tests with, you know, next to Jem, in fact. We were standing next to each other, and my internet was terrible. His was fine. So I did speed tests, and my speed was almost nothing. Now, you start getting a bit paranoid. You start wondering, well, Jen said, well, there's probably a list of like 100 activists, you know, that they just throttle their internet slower. So, you know, they do selective slowing of their internet just to frustrate people so that they can't post things, climate activists. So I don't know if that's the case, but I do know there was a COP27 app, the official app from the UN on the conference. And that allowed the Egyptian government to know to actually access your phone and your camera so they could hear what you were saying. They could, they could see what was going on. And also they knew your location just from that COP27 app. And there were some articles on that before the conference. So I didn't download the app. But when you come into Egypt, you go to the phone company, Vodafone. And if you're with the COP, they give you a free Vodafone SIM card. You know, that has all that tracking capability on it, like the COP app. So they don't get you one way, they get you the other way. But, I mean, I've got nothing to hide, so it doesn't really bother me.
Well, let's make a fond hello to the government of Egypt, and please keep working on your own climate policies. Lots we could say about that. Have you seen any major climate pronouncements so far that you think could actually work?
The funny thing is the conference is so large. I have been around the entire thing. Like, I've seen the plenary rooms, and I've seen the main areas. And often, you know, when the world leaders are in there discussing, then they're not open to the public. Like, it's very... You know, there's very different levels of hierarchy in what you can get into and what you can't get into. I read the summary in The Guardian each evening and on what's happened at the COP. And, you know, some of the things I know about, and but many of the things to do with the negotiations, et cetera, you know, that's how I find out about them. It's not, unless you're in the meeting room, then, you just don't know. You have, you know, I find out about a lot of really good events from, say, Nick Fries, for example, who, I mean, he interviewed Catherine Hayhoe just yesterday, and I got to meet her, you know, the evangelical climate scientist. Like, she's Canadian, but she's quite well known as a climate educator. It's a huge circus in a way. Like, it's nowhere near the most efficient way to get action done on climate. And I mean, now let me turn around and ask you, I mean, have you come across much news on the COP in your neck of the woods in Vancouver?
Very, very little. It's not being covered on the television news at all. Although I have to say that I'm not seeking it out as much, since I'm a little bit pessimistic about what's really going to come out of this. You may be in the richest part of it, Paul, in the sense it may feel like voices in the wilderness, but actually you're meeting some of the people who do matter. I think Nick Breese is one of them with Climate Gen. Climate Gen is just Climate, G-E-N-N, and he just did another really good interview with Jason Box, the glaciologist that I talked to on Radio EcoShock. And that gets us back to glaciology, which I know is one of your loves. And I think this is going to be key to the future of the world. People think it's extreme hurricanes and droughts and floods and heat. And it is all that. But sea level rise is going to rewrite the maps of our world and sink some of the most populous cities and coasts and all that. You've heard all that. So why do you think glaciology is coming to the fore now?
You know, we're finding out more and more that the major ice sheets on Greenland and Antarctica are nowhere near as solid as we thought. For example, on the sea level curves for the different scenarios of warming from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change reports, right, they have a sort of a band of curves rising upward sort of exponentially, but they're all still fairly low sea level rise by, say, 2100. And then they had a dashed line going up. Now, there was just a conference on a cryosphere conference in Iceland in August, and there were something like 200 or 300 scientists there, glaciologists and sea ice experts and people. And, you know, one of the big presentations that they were all talking about was this curve of sea level, where the dashed line curve that was in there had something like 1 meter of sea level by 2070, and it went up to a couple meters by 2100, sort of in an exponential fashion. Now, years ago, I said back of the envelope calculation, is it possible for us to have, say, 7 meters of sea level rise by 2070? And like that's considered absurd, and it still is. But here's a curve that was presented at the conference in Iceland, where it was 1 meter by 2070. So they're getting closer to what I think would be the reality. You know, scientists don't tend to believe things unless there's a paper on it or multiple papers on it. I mean, another example is the warming rate of the Arctic relative to the global average, because it's always been in two and a half times, right? So all of the media articles, all of the scientists would say it's warming twice as fast, and yet you show them a curve that shows, hey, the warming is at least four times as fast. And because it's not published yet in a paper, they all parrot the number double. And now finally, just a few months ago, a paper came out, and it clearly shows it's four times faster temperature rise in the Arctic. So then you start hearing that a little bit in the media and stuff. I mean, even scientists, it takes a long time, because they're so specialized, they just take the word of other scientists, right? How the whole thing is built up. So it takes some time to actually readjust to data which shows things are much worse than they think. And that's true in just about all aspects of climate science. As you know, everything's happening faster than expected. Well, the expectations are completely wrong. You know, they're always on the conservative side. So, but I think the biggest effect coming at humanity in the short to midterm is the extreme weather events are going to greatly accelerate. I mean, the idea of 1.5 degrees is absurd, and yet there's still people, you know, negotiators and stuff that are talking about this number. But at least now they're conceding, well, we'll probably pass, we probably can't hold the 1.5, but then they start talking about, well, we'll pass 1.5 for a short period of time, sort of, and then back it off. Well, tell me how that's going to happen. right now, you know, it's just not. I mean, the 2 degrees is probably gone too. So then you have to start thinking about 3 or 4 degrees, and, you know, there's not going to be a lot of ice on Antarctica and Greenland, but how long will it take for that ice to be lost? Well, the mechanisms, one of the reasons why the sea level rise dashed line was a meter by 2070 and 2 meters plus by 2100 is because of these different marine ice sheet instabilities. You know, one of them being water's heavier than ice. So water on the surface of the ice finds its way to the bottom of the ice. You know, it creates crevices, it creates cracks, it opens up moulins. It's, you know, warmer than the ice, so it's melting through like a drill. Well, we've known about that for a while, but it turns out that that can greatly accelerate the movement of the ice sheets towards the ocean. And we know that the removal and collapse of ice shelves are creating greatly increased rates of glacier flow, because it's like removing a cork from a bottle. We know that the intermediate water of the ocean is warming very, very large amounts, and it's very salty and warm, so it's not at the surface because it's denser than the surface water, which is colder and fresh. But that intermediate water is undercutting the glaciers, and there were some papers, you know, on East Antarctica where that was being measured, also on Thwaites Glacier, where they call the Doomsday Glacier. So all of these things are happening. It's changes in the AMOC, the ocean circulation. There's more recognition in the scientific community that, hey, you know, really bad things can happen very quickly, and they really wouldn't acknowledge that possibility before. But now it's being talked about, at least, and scientists are starting to say, well, how do we have a formulation sort of for what can actually happen, you know, if these worst-case scenarios happen. And these are really sort of, they call them the fat tails, if you like, of the exponential distribution curve. But what I really think is going to happen is we're going to get simultaneous failure of the major food-producing regions of the world, you know, say in a decade, or, you know, 5 years, a decade, decade and a half. And this is going to cause global food shortages, spikes in prices. There's going to have to be a huge amount of money flowing from rich countries to poorer countries, or we're going to get mass starvation events in these poorer countries. I don't think we can avoid that sort of scenario.
We saw it once a little bit in 2010 when the Russian wheat crop failed, and that caused wheat prices to go up around the world, and then geopolitical unrest. So there's lots to talk about there. So as we finish up our time here, do you have any gossip or inspiration or interesting stories that you would like to pass on, Paul Beckwith?
I like Peter Fiakowski's view. So he's an engineer. He was a chip engineer, not the potato chips, but you know, Silicon Valley developed companies that had imaging systems to image chips as they were, computer chips as they were being manufactured and processed, et cetera. And, you know, his products, the company's products were needed by many of the big producers. So that sort of set him up. And then, he's had other business ventures. But he started being concerned about climate, and he found my videos, and he found people like you and your show, and he found, the guy McPherson's. And he started investigating as an engineer would for himself, and he was very concerned about what he saw. So, you know, he's really switched his focus to, you know, what can we do about the climate issue? And so we talk about his book mostly in the half-hour interview, and I'm really assessing, you know, what his views are, and I've had some information from the Cambridge climate repair people. We had Sir David King was supposed to come and be on one of our panels, but he couldn't, so we had an eight-minute video that he made for the panel about, you know, the climate restoration sort of ideas. I mean, Peter's view is for a solution to be viable, it's got to be, one, it's got to be scalable, two, it's got to be permanent, and three, it's got to be self-financing. So it's got to generate some money. So there's four sort of solution areas he looks at. I mean, he really likes the idea of carbon capture in cement and carbon capture to make limestone, because there's a market for limestone and cement. You obviously, you know, huge demand in the world, you know, huge amounts of mining going on. And if we don't need to dig up the materials, then we can mass produce them, but with carbon that we capture from the air. And then that's, you know, it fits the requirements, those three requirements that I said. And the idea of growing massive amounts of kelp in the ocean, not just on coastlines, but in surface, you know, deep ocean areas with obviously unique platforms, things like that.
From COP27 in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt, we have been speaking with Canadian climate scientist Paul Beckwith. You can track Paul's latest videos on his YouTube channel or his website, paulbeckwith.net. And I'll put links in my show blog, of course, at ecoshock.org. Paul, it's great to talk with you, and please keep your head above the crowd and come back to us safe.
Okay, well, thank you. It's always a pleasure chatting with you, Alex.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith. Get all our previous programs at our website, ecoshock.org.
PUC Radio coming up after this message.
Hi, listeners. This is Carl G. from the Abolitionist Hour on Radio Free Kansas. Every Saturday night from 7 to 9 p.m., we'll talk about prisons since the Fugitive Slave Act to the Attica Uprising to 2018 prison strike. Stay tuned for more information on strikes and rebellions wherever they occur. Only on the Abolitionist Hour on Radio Free Kansas. Every Saturday night from 7 to 9 p.m. See you there.
TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of useful consciousness. Imperial San Francisco, the underground history of the gold rush. This is part of the story of a city grown from 16 houses on sand dunes in 1850 to the largest city on the Pacific coast in only 30 years. The book Imperial San Francisco by Dr. Gray Brecken is one of the few examples of a scholarly dissertation that describes history in a new way and then becomes a very popular book. Imperial San Francisco brings to light the huge sacrifices extracted from the surrounding land by any city, from Babylon to the Italian city-states to the instant cities of North America. Gray Brecken says that he tried to answer the question he posed himself. Was it worth it? Today's program focuses on gold mining and the fate of the forests. Next week, we will talk about the valleys flooded and rivers diverted to bring water to San Francisco. Was it worth it? And really, also by extension, what was it worth for whom? Because only a small part of the wealth extracted from California to build San Francisco can actually be traced to the buildings and bridges, parks and waterworks of the city. The overwhelming portion lies hidden in the wealth of the families that ran, and in many cases still run, the city, in corporations, banks, and real estate. This is a provocative, intriguing, and unusual way of looking at a city, especially at one that everybody loves, San Francisco, the beautiful, the dream of travelers and immigrants. Gray Brecken opens chapter 1 with a metaphor, the maelstrom described by the poet Edgar Allan Poe. The maelstrom is a legendary whirlpool off the coast of Norway. Observed from the cliff above, the sea all of a sudden begins to boil and a funnel opens up. Here's Gray Brecken reading from that vignette.
Nothing that fell within the maelstrom's reach could resist the suction of the vortex, or the transformation that it wrought on all that it swallowed. Ships vanished. Hapless whales and bears were dragged howling into the hole. The trunks of firs and pine trees, quote, after being absorbed by the current, rise again broken and torn to such a degree as if bristles grew upon them. And that's Poe's account of the opening of the whirlpool, a very apt metaphor for what cities do to the natural world. They transform it. They pull everything into it and then spit it out, totally transformed, often completely wasted.
I had on my wall for a long time a copy of a little etching that was done just over 150 years ago, which showed San Francisco as a tiny village, and there were about 15 houses, including a prison.
Yeah. It was a vast field of sand dunes and lakes, not very many creeks because it was so sandy that the creeks ran underground, and then a few hills poking up above the sea of undulating sand dunes. There were marshes. And then with the announcement of gold, right after the conquest of California by the United States, suddenly tens of thousands of people, almost all of them men, began arriving from all over the world. And that, of course, dramatically changed not only the site of San Francisco itself, but in fact, first all of California, which is sort of the outer ring of the whirlpool, which it pulled into itself. And then Hawaii, Nevada, Oregon, the entire Pacific Basin, in fact, becomes the ever-expanding whirlpool, which was pulled into the financial district of San Francisco to make a few fortunes of those sort of legendary families that you read about in history books.
Now, you say in your book that the economy of the gold rush was really one that fueled the first growth and expansion of the city.
Well, it was the gold that began pulling people into California, and it's still used as a useful metaphor for drawing more people into California. We haven't located anybody who made a dynastic fortune from the gold rush itself. And the people who really made money were those who got the land. Some manufacturers and importers, but mostly the people who got here and got the land. And for those people, there could never be too many people. So what the gold rush did was to provide a kind of a magnet to draw people in to give the land value. And it was very effective in that. Later on, they would use the public treasury to increase the value of the land in a number of ways. But the first thing was the gold itself, or the lure of the gold.
There's a chart in your book that shows that really only the first few years of the gold rush were a boon to the individual digger. And very soon thereafter, gold was needed to bring out the gold.
Yes. There's an old saying amongst miners that it takes a mine to run a mine, actually, and that's very appropriate. That chart really amazed me when I saw it. It peaks out, and then it begins falling almost as sharply as it rose. There were tens of thousands of men tearing apart the Sierra to get the gold. But eventually, there were so many of them that they got all the readily available gold, the placer gold that was in the streams, and then the production begins falling off. And what that then means is that then you have to begin using high technology and capital to get the gold. And what that means is that you need a stock market. And the stock market was established in San Francisco in 1862, not only to get the gold, but to get the silver in Nevada. And that's where people really made their fortunes, other than in land. They made it by manipulating insider information on the San Francisco Mining Exchange, which was connected to other stock exchanges through the world by the new invention of telegraphy.
You also say that quite a few people were aware of the presence of gold in California and had already placed themselves in a position to benefit from it before it was officially discovered.
Yes. Yes, that's part of the myth of California, that John Marshall discovered gold in January 24th, 1848, and that was repeated actually on the 150th anniversary. California began a series of commemorations about that signal event. But what really surprised me was I found that gold, the presence of gold was already known. There had already been a gold rush in 1842 at the San Fernando Mission in Southern California, and about 2,000 ounces of gold had been sent back to the mint in Philadelphia. This is 4 years before the United States, in fact, attacked Mexico and began the Mexican-American War to acquire California. Even President Polk, in his outgoing address in 1848, December of 1848, when he announced the discovery of gold in California, said that the presence of gold and many other things was already well known in California at that time. And the newspapers in California in 1847, very earliest newspapers were reporting gold, sulfur, mercury, oil, coal, all sorts of stuff that was already being developed. And officially, California wasn't even part of the United States at that time, but it soon would be, of course.
What kind of technologies were spawned by this sudden influx of money?
One of the first things they did was called river mining. They actually tore down forests, milled them into lumber, and then created giant flumes to divert whole rivers out of their beds. Then they would bring in Chinese coolies, who would blast and excavate the entire bed of the river while there was no water in it, as fast as possible, because once the rain started and the floods began, the flume would probably be completely washed away. So you only had a few months to work on that. That required huge amounts of capital, and that could only be raised on stock markets. Then you had hard rock mining, and that required very high levels of capital to go to dig your shafts and tunnels into the earth to get the stuff, and to have the mills for reducing the ore and the smelters and everything else. But the most destructive of all was hydraulic mining. Hydraulic mining went after those buried rivers. And here again, this is high technology which was pioneered in California starting in 1852, when several inventors began to realize that you could create a hydraulic infrastructure by damming rivers high at their heads, creating a high head of pressure, and then with high pressure iron pipes, bring that water down to a lower level and release it through giant water cannons called monitors. And with this, you could tear apart the landscape and uncover these fossil rivers, which were buried up to 600 feet deep. They did that. When I saw the photographs taken by Carlton Watkins of those operations, I was just stunned, as people were at the time, because this is really humanity becoming a geological force. And I wondered, what did that look like to the natives who just a few years before had never seen a white man before? And suddenly, into their land comes not only these white men, but they're absolutely ripping apart everything that they had known. I thought it must have looked like thermonuclear war to them. But it also had terrible environmental impacts downstream, because this was sort of free enterprise run amok. And the whole idea of hydraulic mining was that the waste that was produced from the what was called the overburden became the problem of the next guy downstream. That was off your property and you didn't care. And that meant terrible floods down below, which destroyed towns, farms, buried the farmlands in sand and gravel up to the tops of oak trees. And so ultimately that was stopped by a pioneer court decision in 1884 called the Sawyer decision, which really rocked the whole industry of mining and is often regarded as one of the first environmental lawsuits. But in fact, it's not. It's the triumph of one form of real estate over another.
I like this little story of 1862, where Leland Stanford had to be rowed to his inauguration because Sacramento was flooded.
The Sacramento River became 40 miles wide. It essentially filled up the whole Sacramento Valley from the Sierra foothills to the Coast Range. And so Sacramento became a kind of Venice. It was completely flooded, and Leland Stanford had to be rowed up to the state capitol to take his vows as the Republican governor. By the way, he was also president of the Central Pacific Railroad at the same time that he was governor, which provided a nice conflict of interest if you wanted public subsidies.
Actually, before we go into talking about how mining now got in conflict with the emerging farming and agriculture downstream, let's talk just a little bit more about the deforestation. What I found really shocking to read in your book, that many railroads were just built in order to bring in more lumber.
Railroads were typically extended out to get resources, almost secondarily to carry people, in fact, although you carry people to bring them in, actually to increase the value of the land. So when San Francisco gets going, like any city, in fact, a shockwave of deforestation spreads out from the city to get lumber and to get fuel to run the city. And this happens with all cities, I believe, but it couldn't be altogether effective until the railroads were built and extended out into the lumber regions. And then they acted very effectively as weapons against the forests. And forests all around San Francisco and every other city that developed, Sacramento and all, began to have a devastating effect on the forest, and particularly in the Sierra Nevada. The Sierra Nevada has been almost entirely lumbered off because of the need for wood, as well as the need for fuel, because California is rich in almost everything except coal. It doesn't have coal, and so they were burning wood to a great extent. And then the railroads themselves required fuel to run, but also for railway ties. And San Francisco became a port of export for building railroads throughout the Pacific. So redwood trees, for example, became ties in the railroads in Peru and Chile, for example, throughout the entire Pacific.
Also, the lumber that was used to shore up the underground mines.
Well, one account is they deforested the Sierra for 100 miles on the east side facing Nevada, and then they began chewing into the forests around Lake Tahoe. The Tahoe Basin was almost entirely deforested. Gigantic timbers, which were linked up together into three-dimensional cubical constructions underground in order to get the bonanza bodies of ore out. They had never run into such large ore bodies before. Previously, you would just tunnel in, but now you had to construct actually gigantic buildings, like skeletal frame buildings underground, and you did that with the wood from the Sierra. And that caused a tremendous amount of devastation and erosion. And it's even one writer on the Territorial Enterprise in Virginia City actually said it was causing climatic changes in Nevada, because as you stripped off the trees, the snow melted faster, causing floods in Nevada. And in fact, the climate had become more extreme. Now, that's a very interesting environmental observation at that time.
The debris that now began to wash down the rivers came partly from the hydraulic mining, partly from the deforested hillsides, but the debris that then filled the rivers below and began filling the bay and showed up as a plume outside the Golden Gate,
yes.
The debris was also carried toxins, mining toxins with it.
Well, yes, but before I get to that, I want to say that, you know, it was also road building, any kind of construction. There was no concern for, you know, treating the land well, and then setting fires, whether accidentally or deliberately, because the gold miners were always looking for quartz ledges, and there was chaparral or trees in the way, so they just set fire to it. So did the sheep herders. They wanted better grass for their herds, so they'd set fire to the forest too. So here you have an environmental holocaust triggered within just a few years, which had a devastating impact on the Sierra that John Muir came, you know, and began commenting on when he came here. But also, wherever you have gold and silver mining, in those days, you also will find mercury, because mercury has an affinity for the precious metals. It amalgamates with them. And California was either fortunate or very unfortunate in that it has a lot of mercury, but in the coast ranges rather than in the Sierra. So they would get the mercury out of cinnabar ores in the coast range and refine it and then take it over to the Sierra, which doesn't have naturally occurring mercury, and then use it in great quantities to trap the gold and the silver. So all the rivers, anywhere that there was gold or silver mining now, you're going to find that the rivers are permanently contaminated with mercury. San Francisco Bay is horribly contaminated with mercury in the sediments on the bottom, as is Clear Lake, where there were a lot of mercury mines at that time, too. And this works up the food chain. It becomes methylated mercury and works up the food chain. So it's not a very good idea to eat fish or shellfish out of these bodies of water, in fact.
What happened when farmers who began to settle in the valleys below the Sierra Nevada, what happened when they realized that this toxic sludge was drowning their orchards and their fields?
The farmers had come and began establishing a great agricultural industry in California in the late 50s and the 60s, and they were largely supplying the miners who needed food from the valleys. And there are these great alluvial valleys of California that are filled with very, very rich soil. And they realized that this, combined with the climate in California, could produce bonanza crops. And so they were starting to get rich by farming the land. But at the same time, these great debris flows were coming down the rivers. Anytime that there was a spring runoff, what you would get was not clear water, but essentially a kind of a thick slurry of yellow mud, which would vomit out of these canyon mouths and spread over the land, because since the rivers no longer had any beds, since they'd filled with sediment, the rivers had nowhere to go except over the land, and then they just covered it with these sterile slickens, they were called, which is gravel and fine sediment, sand, mud, clay, and such. And this is not at all fertile. This is essentially just sterile stuff that would take thousands of years to break down. And this buried the finer soils and, in fact, and destroyed the towns, destroyed the farms. There are accounts of trees being buried up to their topmost branches, full-grown oak trees. In some places, the sediments were 80, 90 feet deep. So it was like having a giant glacier sort of move down, a permanent one, move down from the mountains and bury everything that you had. So they, although they were supplying the miners and they realized that miners were a source of wealth, at the same time they realized that everything that they depended on was being destroyed, and so they instituted lawsuits to try to stop the mining. And so it was kind of a tremendous shock in California when Judge Lorenzo Sawyer handed down an injunction against the mines in 1884. But that also marks sort of the shift in California from mining as the primary industry to agriculture as the primary industry. But I should also say that, you know, the way that farming has traditionally been practiced in California is not the kind of benign image that we have of farming, where the farmer occupies the land and tills it and knows his particular piece of land. It's land monopoly, and many of the so-called farmers are absentee. They may live in the cities, actually, and work the soil from a good long distance through managers. And they also were trying to get as rich as possible, particularly through wheat farming, and so they would raise bonanza crops of wheat year after year without replenishing the soil until the soil was virtually exhausted. So at the turn of the century, the novelist Frank Norris wrote a great novel called The Octopus about the battle between the railroad and the so-called farmers. And he says in that book, farming as it is practiced in California is simply another extension of mining. That 25 years before, these guys had been mining. Now they were mining the soil. And it was the same thing. He called it the true California spirit. After us, the deluge. They didn't care, he said. And that's true. They essentially exhausted the soils in California, too. So this ethos of mining is both a real thing, which is dramatic, but it's also a metaphor for the way that our culture does so much its getting of money. It is the very sort of paradigm of non-sustainable development, where you extract stuff and you send the waste downstream, downwind, and preferably down time to posterity to worry about and to pay for. And that is the very definition of non-sustainable development. And that's the way we do so much, not just mining, but agriculture, agribusiness, and so much else that we do today.
You just said it took years for the Anti-Debris Society to get a court decision in their favor. So there were huge forces at work who wanted to preserve mining. And I try to imagine, going back to San Francisco, the city at that time that had grown up to depend on mining and had the whole south of Market area was a iron industry section. They were building all the machines. So what they needed to do, find a new market for the machinery of mining that they wanted to continue to prom.
Yes, San Francisco is very interesting. Market Street is the broadest street in the city. It's 120 feet wide, and it sort of bisects north of Market from south of Market. And north of Market was the financial district. That's the area of gold. South of Market was the industrial and immigrant area. That's the iron district, where the ironworks and the smelters and the refineries were very unhealthy. The wealthy lived on the other side of Market Street. And it was the greatest machine-producing area in the whole Pacific Basin because of the need for mining equipment, the most advanced mining equipment, which was constantly advancing, by the way. It was a period of tremendous technological innovation. And not just mining machinery for California and Nevada. They were exporting this to Mexico and throughout the whole Pacific Basin, even as far away as South Africa. Now, when the Sawyer decision stopped hydraulic mining in 1884, that essentially put an end to much of the market for this mining machinery. Many of the mining engineers then scattered around the world, particularly to South Africa. And that meant that the really canny iron workers, owners of the ironworks, had to find some new market. And so one of the lead ones, a man named Irving Murray Scott, who is one of my main characters, then saw the main chance and shifted into armaments and began producing Primo battleships, which would come in very, very useful in the Spanish-American War in 1898.
It's really amazing to consider that all this was done within a generation, from a sleepy hamlet to this smoke-fire-belching place of production. San Francisco became a huge export town in just 30 years.
Well, everybody commented on that at the time. I mean, it was an instant city. And, you know, the fact that within 25 years of its effective founding in the gold rush, San Francisco had the greatest hotel in the world, the Palace Hotel, which was built on silver profits. It had, you know, major banking institutions. It had the leading mining stock market in the world. It was connected through to the rest of the city by railroads, telegraphs, everything. It was by far the leading city in the entire West. There's nothing on the East Coast that's comparable. I mean, this was it, the city. Everybody in the West referred to San Francisco as the city. The Portland, Seattle, Los Angeles were only beginning at that time, sort of cow towns. San Francisco was it. So It was the great whirlpool, the maelstrom of the West, and it needed to pull everything into it in order to build itself.
You know, it's not that they didn't know at that time. I was fascinated by this report you referred to in your book that Carl Gilbert went around and did research between 1905 and 1909 to see what the deferred costs of mining had been.
Yes, Groot Carl Gilbert was one of the great geologists, American geologists, and the U.S. Geological Survey sent him out after about 20, 30 years after the hydraulic mining had stopped to find out what the damage had been, and he produced a terrific report, which is a classic in its kind, about the tremendous damage. And he estimated that the amount of overburden removed in hydraulic mining within a few years was about 8 times the volume removed for the Panama Canal. All of this had been sluiced down into the Central Valley and ultimately into San Francisco Bay. So that's a tremendous amount of land moved.
Just for a moment to go back to the opening metaphor of the maelstrom, after really, virtually, really pulling trees and bears, as Edgar Allan Poe says, into this maelstrom from the Sierras, now the maelstrom reaches as far as British Columbia, as South Africa, as overseas to pull these societies into the maelstrom of mining, where it even persists in some places until today.
You can read articles on how the miners in Brazil, in Java, Indonesia, all around the world are now being poisoned by cyanide and by mercury, and communities are being devastated everywhere by the kind of mining which was forbidden in California but then exported to the rest of the world. So it's still going on today. It's even going on actually in Nevada with the gigantic cyanide heap leaching piles, which are demolishing entire mountain ranges and draining whole aquifers, which will dry up rivers and springs, etc. But the real devastation is continuing in places like Burma and Thailand and Colombia, where they're today using the exact same kind of hydraulic mining techniques that were banned in California because of the environmental destruction. And these are frequently financed by U.S. or Canadian companies, which wouldn't allow those kinds of techniques in their own country. So you export the damage elsewhere. And very few people are aware of this.
That was a conversation with Dr. Gray Brecken from the archives of TUC Radio. We were talking about the chapter on gold mining from his book, Imperial San Francisco, Urban Power, Earthly Ruin. We spoke in Inverness, California on August 8, 2000. Meanwhile, Brecken's book, Imperial San Francisco, has become a classic in urban studies and was republished in 2006. Gray Brecken is visiting scholar in the UC Berkeley Department of Geography and has embarked on a new project that continues to give him pleasure and inspiration. He and a team of researchers are chronicling the often forgotten works of the 1930s and 40s New Deal. The livingnewdeal.org website shows the record of a lost society, of a once intensely public-spirited America. They have so far mapped more than 17,000 sites across the U.S., and that amounts to more than 100 sites in every state. Workers built thousands of exquisite monuments to public life, from post offices, schools, theaters, to parks, museums, and botanical gardens. Also utilitarian projects, such as municipal water and sewage systems, airports, and bridges. All this can serve as contrast and inspiration to the current New Deal. You can even give your input at the livingnewdeal.org website. Come back next week when Gray Brecken talks about how Imperial San Francisco got its water and the partial flooding of Yosemite Park. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, TUCradio.org. Look at the newest programs or
the podcast page. While you're there, you can subscribe to weekly free podcasts. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.